Welcome to How to Master the Art of Managing People, cassette number one in Dr. Mortimer Feinberg's series, Practical Psychology for Managing People. In this program, Dr. Feinberg will be talking to you about the single most important key to your success as a manager, executive, or supervisor. And that key is your ability to get other people to do what must be done to make your project, your department, or your company a profitable and successful one. Few of us are born with a magical ability to lead other people, to motivate them, and to control them. For most of us, getting consistently superior results is an art and a skill which must be developed. But the process of developing this ability, the ability to manage other people, need not be a long or a hard one, and in this program, Dr. Feinberg goes a long way toward making effective people management a lot easier for you. The specific ideas and suggestions you'll hear about today are based on a professional lifetime of research, consulting, and management experience. You can rely on these techniques and methods to get results for you. All of them have been proven in the field by hundreds of other managers who have used them successfully. Before we turn to Dr. Feinberg, let me spotlight some of the key ideas you'll be hearing about. Dr. Feinberg will first explore with you the uses of contingency management, a discussion that will give you practical insight into the day-to-day uses of rewards and punishments in managing your people. He'll then turn the spotlight on the 10 deadliest demotivators, the things you should not do if you want to be able to lead and control other people effectively. I think you'll be surprised by some of these demotivators, and surprised at how frequently they're used by managers at all levels. With these important preliminary ideas fully explored, Dr. Feinberg then devotes the rest of the program to a thorough discussion of very specific techniques you can use to turn on your employees. You'll hear about the psychic rewards that can add tremendous power to your managerial ability. You'll hear about the uses and abuses of money as a motivator. And you'll hear about dozens of other tricks of the trade that can make you a powerful, effective, and productive executive. The best way to get the most out of this program is to listen to it from beginning to end to get the gist of Dr. Feinberg's ideas. Then listen again to be sure you fully understand the techniques that are most important to you. And finally, keep it handy so that you can turn to it again and again as you face new challenges and new difficulties in managing other people every day on the job. So let's turn now to Dr. Feinberg and his program, How to Master the Art of Managing People.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Today I want to talk about the most difficult of all problems or challenges in management, and that is how to master the art of managing and motivating people. I guess this topic is one of the most challenging to the industrial psychologist, and I have spent many years observing different methods for handling this problem. The art of managing people may very well be at the heart of the survival of our free enterprise system. We all know what's happening in Japan, where every single day another article comes out about how the Japanese do so much better job than we do in the Western culture in managing and motivating others. So I want to focus then on this whole area of rewards and punishments as one of the challenges that we will face. Now, let me point out that we need to understand better the first topic of my dissection of this problem, which is in the area of contingency management. That's a fancy word. You know, psychologists have been accused of explaining things that everybody knows in words that nobody understands. Or industrial psychology has sometimes been referred to as similar to the sex life in elephant. It's practiced at very high levels amongst much noise and confusion. I would like to focus right now on the problem of this area of what is called contingency management And it is how to balance rewards and punishments. You have this problem at home, you have it on the job, the question of whether to use rewards or whether you use punishments. Now, to motivate or to mold behavior. Now, let me point out that the area of punishment is one that psychologists have been against for many generations because we think that, not that it doesn't work, punishment can work. You know, you can whip a person. You can make certain that you punish them by removal of certain benefits, and it does work. The heads of the feudal societies would sometimes box the ears of their sons as they took them around turns to make certain they would remember the turn. There's no question that punishment can stop immediate behavior, can stop certain behaviors. But I want to point out that the problem with punishment lies that it gives you no appropriate new goals, that frequently the person can turn on the punisher, so you hate the person that does the punishing rather than stopping the behavior you want to stop. So I like to better the use of rewards. And here we have the work of the great B.F. Skinner, who is at Harvard and has really been the leader of behavior modification school of psychology. And he has argued with considerable success that positive reinforcement, that is rewarding compliance, is more effective than aversive action that punishes deviations from standards. In other words, that it's much better to use proper effective rewards than it is to use punishment behavior. Two psychologists, Richard Koppelman and George Schneller of Baruch College of the City University of New York, where I have been a professor, had been for 30 years of my life, Koppelman and Schneller suggest that a two-edged sword is available to slay the monster of absenteeism. So you've got a problem in absenteeism. Do you reuse rewards or do you use punishments? They point out that not all absences are equally costly. Those that are most devastating to productivity are ones that occur on short notice or without any notice. Suddenly the guy doesn't show up. Well, that can kill you in your company. Now, the answer, says the advocates of behavior modification, should be a system of rewarding good attendance. Thus, they see a substantial method benefit in methods like that reported by two other psychologists at a meeting of the Industrial Relations Research Association in 1976. Their approach, used in an electronic firm, employed a sophisticated workforce, involved the following. A good attendance record was rewarded by the simple device of setting up a monthly lottery in which only employees with satisfactory attendance records could participate. The prize was a modest $10 paid to winners whose name was extracted from a basket containing the names of all employees who had maintained perfect attendance and punctuality scores for the month. Now, let me point out this technique of a lottery where only people who meet the standards can participate is a great idea. There's a guy by the name of who handles it at Purdue Chicken. There, they used to have a lottery system to award people a Cadillac if they had a perfect attendance record. Those who did not were not punished. They just could not participate in the lottery. It worked like magic. People would come in with broken hip bones and broken collars and head abuse. Just to make certain that they didn't miss the opportunity to participate in the lottery. Results were as follows in the study by Koppelman: is a 28% decrease in total sick leave absences were reported over the previous year. Absenteeism was reduced from an average rate of 3.3% to 1.95%. This 41% reduction was particularly impressive in the view of the fact that the original absenteeism rate of 3% was not unusually high to begin with, and yet it was cut significantly by using the method of having people rewarded by getting a lottery system. My father used to say the trouble with life is it's too daily. It's a great idea to reward people in a special lottery and time off in whatever method you can find to handle it. Koppelman and Schneller, the others, on the other hand, believe that setting up, combining both penalties and reward may be even more effective. In other words, that certain kinds of penalties. Their report to the recent session of the Eastern Academy of Management described the organization under study at a large medical center which previously relied on three traditional forms of time off with pay. You can get vacation time off with pay, 10, 15, or 20 days, depending on rank or length of service, holidays, fixed by the calendar, plus the employee's birthday, paid sick leave up to 12 days. The effect of this then-existing system, they wrote, was a severe case of Parkinson's sick leave abuse. That is, the paid sick days taken were expanding to equal the number of paid days that were allowed. In addition, overtime hours tended to increase. The answer to this situation was to provide for a system of both penalty and reward. The basic concept was to establish a leave bank against which employees could withdraw in the event they needed time off. In place of the three formerly independent accounts, that is vacation, holidays, and sick leave, the leave bank created two new accounts called paid leave and sick leave. It worked beautifully. If you give the person an account and say, you own that, and then if you don't use it, you can get it paid in cash, you can significantly reduce absenteeism. So I think we've made the point that positive reinforcement or contingency management works very well. Now, let me give you some recommendations. Six steps to positive reinforcement. The technique can work very effectively if you do the following. One, set up a clearly defined measurable goal. The more specific you can be, the more dramatic the results. In the case of a customer service department, for example, fixing on a numerical goal was a major factor in improvement. Everybody could be certain of what was expected from him. Particularly important is the fact that athletes, for example, are strongly affected by this, where they can set up a clearly defined goal. Athletes know this. Two, explain why the goal is important. Don't assume that it is self-evident in giving your reasons for setting the goal. Show what's important for the company, the customer, the employee, and his fellow employees. Three, provide resources to achieve the goal. Management must determine what is needed to accomplish the results and must create the tools. Four, keep score. The psychologist's emphasis on what we call K of R, knowledge of results, pays off. It is not enough to tell an individual he's doing well. An actual figure based on a numerical goal has great impact. How would you like to be bowling where the screen was in front of the pins and you never knew how many pins you knocked down? All you knew is you threw the ball down. That doesn't work. Five, report promptly. Logic and experience indicate that the employee will be able to improve his pace if he knows where he is at any given moment. Six, provide rewards. Recognition is a form of reward. Nobody has yet disproved Fred Hertzberg's theory that money itself is not going to be a motivator unless it is accompanied by other factors. And during this tape, we will talk about other factors with regard to the Hertzberg theory. Okay, to summarize, 6 points. Get out there, work on rewards. They are much more effective than punishment. And I've given you specific illustrations from my experiences and the research studies which demonstrate how it operates. I guess that probably the best way for me to talk to you about motivation is talk to you what not to do. Then I'll talk to you about what to do. I hate to be a iatrogenic, that is a fancy way of saying doctor-induced illness. Sometimes a doctor, by coming into a situation, makes the person worse rather than better by giving them the wrong medicine. Let me tell you what is the wrong medicine to use when you are working with people, what I call the deadliest demotivators, and then we'll talk about the motivators. One part of my decalogue of the deadly demotivators, which you must avoid, is one, never belittle a subordinate. No one likes to think that others regard him as stupid. He may have doubts of his own, but he doesn't like anybody agreeing with them. Generally, you can reprimand an employee using any other term, lax, lazy, indifferent, sloppy, but call him stupid and you'll rapidly destroy his initiative. Two, never criticize a subordinate in front of others. So one manager I knew once said to me, He said the worst thing about the president of this company is that he criticizes you in the Coliseum and he apologizes on the phone. You gotta criticize somebody, do it in private, never in front of others. This sounds trite and banal. Everyone knows, however, it's a cardinal sin. The temptation, though, is there. The pressure is on. You rush out to your secretary and say, for God's sakes, Marie, can't you ever get it straight? Marie is mortified in front of her fellow workers. She'll never forget the insult, nor will she ever forgive you. Never fail to give your subordinates your unqualified attention, at least occasionally. I once interviewed Eleanor Roosevelt. Many of you on the state may remember she happened to be the wife of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was our fourth-time president. And I once asked her why Franklin was so effective. She said because he only opened up one drawer of his mind at a time. Most of us have one drawer open of our mind and four others slightly ajar. So on occasions, give your subordinates your unqualified attention, and how you demonstrate that is look them particularly in the right eye. Then they will know that you are listening to them. You don't have to devote every working moment to your employees, but from time to time, it is important to give them your undivided attention. Take each person in your office. Give them the privacy. Cut off the phones. Let your secretary know that nobody should interrupt. If you do this, on occasions, the person will feel that you have elevated him by giving him or her your undivided attention. Next, four, never allow your subordinates to think that you are primarily concerned about your own interests. Your own future may very well be your primary concern, but try not to communicate this to others. You don't want them to think that you're selfish, that you're manipulative. Allow them to share the credit. Five, never play favorites. This is a cardinal rule of good management. When you start to make exceptions because of personal preferences, especially when the person you favor is playing up to you, the rest of the staff adopts a what-the-heck attitude. Six, never fail to help your subordinates grow when they are deserving. Try to be a fighter for your subordinates. Many subordinates I have interviewed over 30 years of practice tell me that one of the things they hate most is when the manager doesn't go to bat for them. The company may be hard put for cash, but your employees must feel that you will try to get raises for them if they're deserving. Inform your people of openings within the company. Encourage them to grow. One chairman of the board of a large glass company took his secretary, who was frightened about promotion, and moved her into a manager of personnel. She didn't want to do it, but he gave her the backbone, the inspiration to want to do it. And that spread throughout the organization. Many other secretaries said, why can't we be promoted? Never be insensitive to small things. People are made or broken in small areas. And it's very important that you do not make loose or rash statements. For example, a supervisor in a company of my acquaintance already had a terrible reputation among his department's employees. To top it off, one day he roared in a fit of temper, "I don't care how long you've been at the company, seniority means nothing." The company had been without a union for 75 years. With this crack in management's armor, the union finally gained admissions. An organizing propaganda theme, "seniority means nothing," was used as the basic theme of the message that brought the union in. Small things make a significant difference. I like to send flowers to people when there's a special kind of commemorative thing. It's small, but it shows some concern. An executive of a men's jewelry company asked me about a job offer he had received. It offered him more money and somewhat greater responsibility. I let him talk. Finally, he said, "I can't leave my company. The company president is tough and demanding, but he's considerate in ways I'll never forget." Life is made up of small courtesies. Never miss an opportunity to demonstrate that you're aware of it to your people. Next, never show up employees. It is embarrassing for an employee to have his boss show off at his expense. For example, by doing a particular job better or faster than the employee can do it himself. Most bosses can, and that's why they've risen. But it's important for a man's dignity to be able to do something well on his own. And when you take his work away, you also take away his self-respect. Now, by the way, let me tell you, this works at home, too. Be very careful that you don't show up your sons and daughters. Try to act to some degree like, in quotes, a schmo, that's Gaelic for a little inadequate at home, so that your sons or daughters can demonstrate that they know something, too. Next, remember that you need to avoid giving the demonstration of excessive pressure from the top. That becomes a demotivator. Let me tell you why. Because there's a great psychologist by the name of Tolman who referred to the cognitive map. That is, if I am too anxious about doing a good lecture, my vision becomes narrow, and I get too worried about it. And result of that, I'm unable to look at relationships. I'm unable to look at connections. Too much pressure that we're going to fall apart, or we've got to make this profit, or we've got to do this, or we're going to fail, or we're going to go bankrupt. That constant riding herd on people becomes a demotivator and counterproductive. Some of the ways, by the way, that you know this is happening to you is the following. Frequent complaints about the workload. Inordinate requests for transfers. Undue moving around and restlessness on the job. Tense flare-ups between people. Irritations at new assignments. If this is a problem, it's not necessary to relax standard, but it may be a good idea for the manager to become less omnipresent. The manager should delegate more what is appropriate, where it's appropriate. Where additional delegation is not a good idea, he should make a point to at least permit workers to express themselves to him. It's important to recognize too much pressure can be counterproductive. And let's not forget that inadequate conditions or equipment can be demotivators. People particularly resent what they consider to be handicaps imposed upon them because of the company's cheapness or indifference to their working conditions. Some of the ways you can tell that this is happening to you are the following. Frequent complaints about the working conditions. Observations that people in other departments have a cleaner place to work. Unforeseen foul-ups and delays. Carelessness about equipment and materials. Failure to make necessary minor adjustments in their equipment. Frequent calls for repair or consultation. I have given you the Decalogue. Some of them may seem obvious to you. Some of them may seem trite. Let me tell you, it is important to remember them. Maybe make up a list of the 10 demotivators and keep them in front of you just so that you're constantly reminded of their importance. You can do more by avoiding something than you can necessarily by adding something. I am therefore going to now turn to what you can do. I've told you what not to do. Now let me tell you what you can do. Now let's talk about the positives. And I guess the first thing to talk about is money. Money traditionally has been perceived as the sole motivator, or sometimes it is dismissed as being unimportant. And I'd like to give a balance to this approach about money, which comes from many years of experience of observing how people respond to economic rewards. As Milton Berle once said, money may not be in first place, but it beats whatever is in second place. So let's look at it. The human mind is a fascinating phenomenon. I never cease to be amazed by it. Just a few months ago at a Christmas bonus time, the president of the company suddenly found that there's a small entrepreneurial company that he had a lot of money to distribute. And his quote was, rather than give it to the government, I'll give it to my people. And so he decided to give out bonuses, and the bonuses were relatively modest, maybe $50 a person. And do you know that some of the people were so upset that they thought he was demeaning them by giving them $50? They would have been, they said they'd have been better off if they didn't get anything. Now, how does one understand that? And I think the reason for it has to be understood in terms of money as a motivator. Do you know that if you overpay people, you may reduce their motivation? That some people, on the whole, find that they are worse off, they reduce their output. They may increase the quality of their work, but they reduce their output. There's a great psychologist at Yale University called Leon Festinger, and he's worked on the concept of cognitive dissonance. Dissonance fundamentally hypothesizes that the human mind needs to stay in equilibrium. And when you upset that equilibrium, people tend to try to bring it back to equilibrium. If you overpay people, they wonder what's behind it, and they keep increasing the quality of their work, not necessarily the quantity of their work. I think it is best to maintain the facade of some kind of connection between compensation and performance. Even when you're convinced that it is being honored more in the breach than in the observance. On the whole, management must remember that the power of wages still remains a major, though not the sole, motivator of an employee's performance. There is increased concern about the continuance of income through job protection, pensions, health and welfare programs, insurance, longer paid vacations, more paid holidays. The desire for increased economic reward still serves as the principal incentive to improve skills, earn promotion, win merit increases, and collect larger take-home pay from wage incentives and profit-sharing programs. However, it is also important to recognize, when we're talking about motivation, that meaningful work, a sense of achievement, recognition, responsibility, advancement, so-called psychological factors play a tremendous role in motivation, but they must not be considered as substitutes for appropriate compensation. Jobs should be engineered to provide the psychological, psychic rewards, if you will, so that an individual might reach his highest level of output. Money must be accompanied by psychic rewards. Now let's look at these so-called psychic rewards. To get inside the head of an individual, one has to understand that if an employee considers his wages inadequate, he'll be less responsive to psychological rewards. If he considers his wages fair, the psychological rewards will be multiplied in their effectiveness. In other words, wages become a multiplier of the psychological. The person is more enthusiastic about the psychological if you have taken care of the wages. I guess it's like making love. You got to do it with the flowers and the music. And if you do that, it's going to increase significantly the rewards from the lovemaking. Now let's look at those psychological factors that are multipliers of the economic. Nobody can deny the tremendous importance of what the Japanese are doing. And whether we're talking about it now in the beginnings of 1980, or whether if this tape lasts in the 1990s, Japan will still go down as the miracle of economic productivity. And it was done not by wages alone. Let me look at some of the factors that are affecting our ability to ensure our productivity. First, beware of your own biases and prejudices towards people so that they do not interfere with your evaluation of performance. All of us have biases and prejudices. no one is completely devoid of them. The question is, are you aware of your prejudices? If, for example, an executive is very unhappy with his plant manager because the manager is always 5 minutes late to meetings, this annoyance may develop into a prejudice. I work with one company where the president of the company is known as a real son of a gun. In fact, they say he used to start with pointed boots. Now he has rounded points because he's been kicking rears so much. But they all like him. And they say no matter how tough he is, he's aware of some of his prejudices. He's aware of some of his biases, and he tries to protect against it. I once did a performance review for the Federal Reserve Bank. And I said to the manager of the Federal Reserve Bank, this performance review program is going to remove your biases in evaluating of a subordinate. And he said, to heck with that. He says, the man has to live with my biases. He said, all you can do, Dr. Feinberg, is make me more aware of them, but you cannot eliminate them. And I think that's a critical factor. Make people aware of their biases. You can't eliminate them. Next, let people know where they stand. Give praise when appropriate. And we're going to talk more about this in the future. I just want to allude to it now. You obviously don't want to praise every little thing that an employee does because suddenly it will lose all its meaning. As one manager told me, my head hurts from being patted too much. Praise is like seasoning. A little bit is a lot better than a lot. On the other hand, don't be afraid to praise. As one manager said, every time I praise a subordinate, he wants a raise. Recognize that the praise should be not connected necessarily to salary increases at that time. It is not important to reward the behavior always by economics, which I pointed out at the beginning of this tape. And remember, finally, don't overpraise, because overpraise is destructive sometimes. The great Jesuit philosopher Gracian once said, true excellence is so rare that one should never belittle it by exaggeration. I like to use athletic illustrations, primarily because I'm not an athlete. I'm just happy I learned to walk, but I love to watch some professionals in the athletic arena. And I call it the pat on the fanny. It's not money. A very familiar form of tribute seen on the ball field when a player makes a great catch or trots across the home plate is part of the morale system that athletes use to strengthen the team. This salute, this pat on the fanny, expresses admiration and is a very effective instrument of nonverbal, non-economic communication. So let's remember that the pat on the rear is as important sometimes as economics. Often in speaking to his people, the coach thinks he is merely imparting information, quite unaware that his players are receiving an entirely different perception of what he's doing. In fact, the more eager a subordinate is to please his chief, the more keenly he searches for cues as to where he himself is being viewed with approval or disapproval. So give the approval when it is appropriate. Next, show you care. I love the poet Phyllis McGinley, who said, sticks and stones can break the bones when thrown with accurate art. Words can sting like anything, but silence breaks the heart. Dante's hell, the coldest spot. You know, everybody thinks of Dante's hell as only being Inferno. But in Dante's hell, the coldest spot was reserved for people who do not care. The man who best motivates others recognizes that others have purposes of their own, that they do not necessarily coincide with those of the manager, The best supervisors generally help their key employees set their own goals. Many executives think they care about employees because they help them to do better jobs. Yet the real test is not merely helping a man carry out your purposes, but are you willing to achieve his purposes too? Let me anticipate one of my future tapes. I'm going to talk to you about the need to make a person increase his feeling of competence by the suggestions you make to him. By building his confidence level, whether he works for you at General Electric, or you at Maury Lulu Laundry, or you at a small candy shop, makes little difference. As long as he thinks you are achieving a feeling for him of greater confidence, you are building a better relationship and a highly motivated subordinate. I guess really as paraphrasing of this, it doesn't mean you do favors for your people. Frequently, it may mean criticizing the person you care about and want to help. Remember, however, that in correcting when there is an error, improving when there is a deficiency, strengthening where there is a weakness, you must first know the individual. You must know what gives him joy and what brings him sorrow. And this may take long hours of hard thought to discover. The great Israeli philosopher, Martin Buber, who talked about the I-thou relationship rather than the I-it relationship, I meaning I manipulate you, the it, to do what I want you to do. But Martin Buber said the most fulfilled individual is an I-thou relationship. And remember that Buber also pointed out that a friend of his once discussed with him, and he said, "Do you love me?" And the friend said, "Yes." He said, "Do you know what hurts me?" And the friend said, "No." He said, "You cannot love me if you do not know what hurts me," which is one of the best definitions of an I-thou relationship. Next, I think it is important to act with an individual as if you are in a partnership. His failures are partly your failures. Successes are partly your successes. I remember Frank Stanton, who used to be head of the CBS, was one of the few psychologists who made it to the presidency of a major corporation in the United States. He's now retired. And Frank Stanton is known to his men, as was known to his men, as a man who cared. When working with a subordinate, he frequently challenged the man with this question: "Is this the best job you and I can do together?" This way, the question is phrased, shows a subordinate that first Stanton assumed responsibility for the success of the project, and second, that Stanton cared. I think it's important to recognize that you need to stay flexible in your relationships with others. Winston Churchill, whom I loved, said it is not a sign of weakness to modify a position or an opinion. There's nothing wrong in change, he said, if it is in the right direction. To improve is to change, so to be perfect is to have changed often. Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "Consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds." Now, let me tell you why flexibility is so important. Weston Labar, who did a fascinating book on the evolution of species, that is, what organisms survive and what organisms die, demonstrated that organisms up the phylogenetic scale that were too consistent, that is, too adapted to one kind of environment, died, fell apart when the environment changed. So the ability to stay flexible, the ability to build some inefficiency into your system, the ability to move from one thing to the other, is a critical factor in survival. Next, I think it is important to allow people to tell you their opinion. Let me tell you, the higher up you go, the more your rear is exposed, and nobody likes to be told about their negatives. I'm going to talk to you in future tapes about the H-bomb of human relationships, which is the critical when you criticize somebody. But I think it's important that executives permit some freedom of expression. And remember, do not hold it against the person who tells you something negative. I was once with a group of professors who went to see the martyred former president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And Kennedy told the professors at that meeting, remember, I will always differentiate the tail from the bearer of the tail. He said, if you tell me something negative about what I'm doing, I will not hold it against you. Now, that is very difficult to do. As you know, messengers are often assassinated by the emperor when they carry bad messages. You know, the Bible tells us this, that you can always tell whether a messenger is bringing good news or bad news. If he's running, he's carrying good news. And if he's walking slowly, the king knows he is carrying very bad news because he's frightened about what the king will do. Next, I think it is important to set high goals for people. We're getting too soft in this culture. We're getting our children soft. We're getting the society soft. And I think it's also important to recognize that often the barbarians always win, because the savages sometimes set high goals. High goals is important. The great John Gardner said the degree of motivation which an individual possesses at any given time is often very much what is expected or demanded of him. American philosophers have always stressed this thesis that we live up to the standards set for us. The setting of high standards is in itself a powerful form of reinforcement. You know the concept of self-fulfilling prophecy. Let me just repeat it. A teacher and a group of students. One student, she liked a group of students and told them they did great on the examination. She wants them to redo it to see if they could do just as well the next time. But they were great. One group of students again lied to them. She said that you did so poorly, you can't be so stupid. Let me see what else you can do and see if you can do any better. A third group, she told nothing, just told them she lost the papers. The group that did the best was the one that was told that they did so well. People have a tendency to live up to those expectations you set for them. Why do you think Dale Carnegie is so popular? Why do you think the power of positive thinking, and every day and every way I'm getting better and better, is so successful in the marketplace? It is successful because people love the feeling of being inspired. People like to set high goals for themselves. However, it is important that you set goals realistically. I think you have to understand that you have to set some personal limitations. Not all of us can be great. Not all of us can be Einstein. We can all be a little bit better, though. And I think it's important in motivation that you, A, set high standards for your people. B, be ready to help them when they seem to be falling short of the goals. I asked Kissinger whom he thought was charismatic leaders. You know, what is charismatic? Charismatic means I inspire you to do better. And he said that charisma is not based upon intelligence. It is based upon the ability to set high goals for your people, but not so high that they become destructive. Illustration. Sadat is one of the great leaders, the one who brought the Egyptians to the peace table with Israel. He's not the most brilliant of all the Arab leaders, but what he did was he inspired his people because he had a vision and he set a high goal. He says, I can bring my people together for this accomplishment. Hitler was a bloody murderer, but he inspired the German people to their own destruction. Good managers, effective people, tend to set goals, and those goals are not beyond the capacities of their people. One of the great debates flourishing in the world of management is whether or not participation is the key to all motivation. The idea that people should participate in decision-making and then bring the decision to the leader. It's a debate going on with regard to Japanese techniques and with American techniques. There's been some criticism that American managers do not permit enough participation and tend to be too authoritarian. I would like to come out on the side of the fact that participation is very important, but it is not that simple that participation will solve all the problems. I believe that it really depends upon the level of sophistication of your people. If you have people who can do things very well and are very bright and very effective, then obviously participation will be very helpful. But I think it's important to recognize that in many cases, the manager knows better how to structure the situation than subordinates. And just to assume that everybody wants to participate in decision-making, I think, is a myth. I think we need to make a very clear line between freedom off the job and freedom on the job. Off the job, people want to be free to do their own thing. That's absolutely true. And especially as we face the 80s, that is true of the younger generation. They are not willing to eat, sleep, and live the company. But on the job, it's a different story. People desire and expect structure, guidance, and direction. They want leaders who tell them very clearly what to do. When the boss asks such people, well, how do you want to do it? They are not inspired and motivated. Rather, they are frequently frustrated. I have found that managers want something solid to bump up against in a boss. You can't bump up against a feather pillow. Employees, even who value freedom above guidance, psychological studies demonstrate, prefer managers who run a tight ship. Even the great psychologists like Dr. Fred Hertzberg and Dr. Maslow, who are known as the great proponents of participative management, and I'd like to quote from them some little-known quotes. One from Hertzberg, he said, to expect individuals at lower levels in an organization to exercise control is unrealistic. Thus, when participation is suggested in these terms, it is usually a sham. And the great, late Abraham Maslow, it is true, opposed rigid authoritarianism. However, Maslow made a basic assumption. He assumed that if a man gets to be a manager, there is every good reason for it. One good reason is that he possesses an overall superiority to the people who report to him. As Maslow points out, for one thing, the superior person is apt to get extremely restless in a situation in which he lacks control, and the strain upon his body is apt to be much greater because of the necessity for controlling himself and inhibiting his impulses. He may easily and quickly see the truth that all others are struggling towards very slowly, and keeping his mouth shut can be terrible torture. There, you are superior as a manager. I don't mean that you should take yourself so seriously that you mean that you're superior all the time. As my father would say, you're a peacock today, but a feather duster tomorrow. Remember, in participative management, let the people talk, but you set up the signals. You are a manager. Unless you are burdened with an extraordinarily weak ego, you must admit to yourself that you are superior. Your superiority is based on more than intelligence and experience. Dr. Maslow points to another kind of strength, a greater than average ability to tolerate anxiety, depression, and anger. You should have those qualities, the ability to tolerate, let me repeat it again, the ability to tolerate anxiety, depression, and anger. And finally, recognize that there's some people who don't need any motivation. Life is very confusing, and I've told you all the things about what not to do, and I've tried to tell you about the things to do. But I want to point out that there are some people who might call comers, people who are so good that really you shouldn't bother to do much in motivation because they are so self-moving. They are the kind of people that need no push from anyone. As one psychologist once said to me, they're the kind of people that you only should do one thing, that is, don't rain on their parade. The best way to management is not to apply the rules we discussed. On the contrary, your best course is simply to get out of their way. But don't be angry at them. Don't get hostile to them, because you could be throwing out of your company one of the great talents. Leave doors open for them. Let them move on through. Let them know what goals you have in mind. Reward him when he gets there. And tell the top managers in the company, man, we got a tiger by the tail. Don't spoil his initiative with overmanagement. He doesn't need you. You need him. If you got a comer, leave him alone. Don't rain on his parade. And be very grateful that God sent you down a bastard with talent, which is one of the things that the great Charles Revson had embroidered on a pillow, which his wife had given him. And I remember puffing it up in the office and said, oh, God, send me down a bastard with talent.